You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Welcome to Earth Station 1, a weekly podcast dedicated to all things sci-fi, fantasy, and much, much more. Sit back and relax and enjoy the show.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Earth Station 1 podcast. That's right, it's Mike and Mike back once again. Hey, Mr. Gordon.
Howdy.
You ready to talk about South Carolina Comic Con and our trip up and meeting Kevin Eastman?
This is a fun one, guys. We had a blast in South Carolina, and I'm glad we can bring this to you guys. This is a really fun interview. Whether you like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or not, Kevin Eastman has secured his place as a Hall of Famer, if you will, of comics, and it was just great to spend some time talking to him.
No, Kevin was very generous to us and also to the fans, and it was a really great show in general. And Kevin was on Sunday was just the icing on the cake, which was perfect.
Yeah, so tune in. But that's not all we got for you. But it's a really good. It's one of our favorite. I think one of our best panels that we've done with a guest.
Exactly. I think it was a lot of interesting stuff. I didn't mispronounce his name, so it was perfect, you know?
That's right.
So it was perfect. And before, you know, we go any further, let us, of course, go ahead and thank, of course, the fine folks at Borderlands Comics, you know, Robert and Michelle and their crew of people. You know, they put on such a great show at the South Carolina Comic Con. I can't rave enough about it.
Absolutely. Yes, that's continues to be one of our favorite conventions to do with of the year. It's a highlight of the year for us.
It is. And, you know, they've already announced the dates for next year's con. So, you know, definitely go to the website, sccomiccon.com. And 2020 is already right on the horizon. And they're moving, thank goodness, back to the end of March. So, you know, it doesn't have us, you know, in competition with basketball tournaments or items like that. So it will also free up parking, which is wonderful, and hotel space.
Right.
So thank goodness with that. And, you know, Robert could tell us, you know, jump so high, we would for him. That's how much, you know, we love dealing with Borderlands and also dealing with, you know, South Carolina Comic Con. So thank you, thank you, thank you. And speaking of thank you for you for listening. You know, we appreciate it as always. We definitely want to hear from you. So please write us at earthstation1@esonetwork.com, or you could call us, of course, at 404-963-9057. You know, leave any feedback, anything you want to talk about, any topics you want us to talk about. This is, you know, your time. This is available to you 24/7. You know, you could call us and just say, hey, Mike and Mike, this is my thought on this. Random thoughts would be great. And if, you know, we'll play it on the air and, you know, we'll answer it. It's a way of communicating to us and such. It's a pretty darn awesome. Of course, you know, a special thank you and shout out to everyone who's been supporting us with our patrons and our Patreon. We especially do that. And thank you for helping financially support the ESO Network. It definitely helps the little bits that we get all the time. And, you know, we try to bring new things to you guys all the time. We exclusively release to our patrons the ESO Network Riffs, which is the second episode. And we are doing Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. And the first one was a huge success. And two was just as fun. We had a great time. We had a great crew. And, you know, it's a great thing to do, and we all got to yell Khan at the same time, kind of, sort of.
Oh, we tried.
We tried, at least. We even had the echo. That's what we'll say, you know? So, but it was a lot of fun, and you could hear it. If you help support the ESO Network patron, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/ESO Network. Doesn't get much easier than that. And we have all different levels. We have a dollar level. We have a $5 level, and we have a $10 level. And for different levels, you get different materials. And our $10 folks, you will be getting special stuff coming to you very, very soon. More to come on that. So definitely, you know, we thank you in advance. And, you know, for everyone who has been supporting us, thank you from the bottom of our hearts. We can't say enough about everybody out there who's been listening to us, who's been financially supporting to us. And, you know, we've been doing this. We're coming up in less than 2 weeks. We are coming up on our 9th anniversary. We're about to start season 10 of Earth Station 1. Woo-hoo. Can you believe that?
No, I can't.
So we got big things planned for the next year, including our 500th episode. So we got a lot coming for you guys. But before we do anything further, we got rants and raves this week, and we got a lot of things to talk about. And so this is just going to be a general topic between Mike and I. And one of the things I wanted to rave about, really rave about, has been, I don't know, Mike, are you still watching The Orville?
I am watching The Orville.
Because this 2 weeks ago, they finished a two-parter, which featured an amazing, amazing storyline that I think in some ways rivals stuff from Star Trek The Next Generation, including Best of Both Worlds.
Okay.
So I enjoyed it a lot, and I thought the whole storyline of the robot race, you know, pretty much, you know, turning out to be all bad and, you know, trying to take over the universe, I thought was, it wasn't like it wasn't foreseen, but it was a neat thing to see happen. And it was just, it was great. And you had the show evolve, I think. I think this is where the show came into its own. There's been a lot of good storylines, I think, with Orville so far. And I like a lot of the topics they've been touching on. And yeah, there's poop and fart jokes in it. But I think that is, I don't want to say it's expected from Seth MacFarlane, but I like what he's doing with Orville. And I'm saying bring it on. And I'm looking forward to whatever they come up with. And I think it's been interesting stuff to do.
Yeah, it's getting it's solid. It's I like the Orville. I watch it every week. I enjoy it for the most part. I'm still not comfortable with how much they are quote unquote borrowing from Next Generation. I mean, in a lot of ways, it feels like a parody of Next Generation, which the people who are making it take very seriously.
I think it's more of an homage now than a parody anymore.
But it, whatever you want to call it, it really, like, they've really taken a lot from Next Generation. I mean, to people who are not in the know, it might as well. I mean, it looks exactly like Next Generation. And so I wish it didn't do that. But it's already established that that's what they're doing. So. So, you know, it is what it is. And I've made my peace with it. I take it for what it is, and I watch it, and they tell some pretty interesting stories. You're right. The two-parter was pretty intense, really well done. The special effects in the battle scene were amazing. The characters are not completely there yet, but I do enjoy them. I think that there's some decent characters, and that's what makes a decent TV show, right? Is the characters. So I do think that they are working on those, and I do give Seth a lot of credit. He is writing, or at least listed as the writer, the main writer of a lot of these scripts. So a lot of it's coming from him, and I think overall it's a fun show.
Exactly. And fun is what we need sometimes nowadays. You know, other shows have been getting darker and darker. And it's just interesting to see what they're going to do with it. And Orville, I think, has been pretty decent. Also pretty decent, I think, some of the DC shows have been, you know, picking up a little bit of steam, I think, especially since this Elseworlds storyline. And now since they're all heading towards Crisis next season, I think they're all working towards something, especially since they just announced that Arrow is going to be ending next season, and it's going to be a shortened season, so probably ending right around Crisis.
Yeah, I've enjoyed most of the CW shows this year. I must admit I'm behind on some of them. I'm really behind on Legends of Tomorrow, so I haven't watched that much. But I am caught up with Arrow, Supergirl, and Flash. And I need to be caught up in the others, but I think they've all been solid. I think the crossover was amazing, but I think they've also, I find it interesting that at least three of the shows are fast forwarding ahead or showing us a future of the same year. Like the flash forwards in Arrow take place in the same year that there's a character in the future that one of the Flash characters keeps visiting in the future. And that's the same year as Arrow, which I understand that year has a lot to do with what's going on with Legends of Tomorrow too. So obviously there's something happening about that year. I don't know. I would imagine that it's going to tie into next year's Crisis of some kind, but we don't know. I mean, it's just fun to watch. But overall, I've been enjoying all of those. And Supergirl in particular, with the recent introduction of Lex, has really stepped up.
Oh, John Cryer has been amazing as Lex. And I was very skeptical you were getting Lenny Luthor as, you know, to come
yeah,
up to
I mean, Lex. Ducky, right? Like, who would have thought that Ducky was going to be like a badass? But, you know, he might end up being one of the best Luthors live action that we've ever had.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And, you know, everything I've seen of John Cryer's Luthor has been fantastic. And I did not expect it. I think that's been one of the biggest surprises of this season, even more so. And I'm going to come out and say it more so than even the Elseworlds story getting Batwoman. I think John Cryer as Luthor has been brilliant.
Well, if I may say, I think John Cryer has been great. He's only been in an episode, and I think he's been off to a good start. Let's put it that way.
Well, he's been chewing up the scenery, basically.
He's definitely played the Luthor that we've wanted to see. But I think as far as a lot of the almost all the CW shows that I'm watching, to me, the standout character this season out of all the shows has been Manchester Black. Really? That's a character that I was familiar with from the story in Superman, What's So Good About the I don't know. I can't remember what the name of the title is, but it's, but I think the character on Supergirl, especially played by, and I'm looking up the actor's name as we speak, David Ajala, I think. I hope I didn't, you know, butcher that.
Take a drink, folks.
Yeah, right. He's phenomenal. Just so good. I am riveted by him when he's on screen every week. He's been saving, like, some of that show to me, like the Brainiac and the I can't remember what the Legion girl's name is, the
Dream Girl.
Yeah, Dream Girl. Okay, well, yeah.
Comic book, she was Dream Girl and then she became Dreamer, so I think she's Dreamer now.
She's fine, but they don't, you know, and some of the stuff they've got going on is kind of interesting, but really, to me, Manchester Black has been like, when he enters the scene, I'm like, oh, now I'm paying attention. So good. So good.
Mm-hmm. No, I like what they've done on Supergirl. I think they've made the shows interesting again, which is nice, because my interest on Supergirl last season was starting to wane a bit. And so I was happy to see, you know, this season, you know, really pick up. And so, you know, good on them. And I like what they've done with Flash. And I like the whole thing that they have going on now with Zoom, or actually, you know, whatever they call, you know, the reverse Flash these right. days. Yeah. And, you know, he's Zoom, he's reverse Flash, he's, you know, who's he, Thawne, he's, you know, it's like, whatever. So I like what they've been doing with that, and I love the things they've been doing with Barry's daughter, and I'm just having a lot of fun with it. And Black Lightning has been amazing. A lot darker than it even was the first season.
I've heard really good things about Black Lightning, and I saw the first episode, and I have not, everything else is stored up. So it is one that I definitely want to check out as well, because I've heard that was one of my favorite shows last year. And I'm looking forward to picking back up again.
Well, it's also fun with Black Lightning playing Atlanta geography with it too. So
yeah, right.
Since they film it here. So it's pretty cool. So, you know, I think it's been a lot of fun, and that's the great thing about it is just, you know, it's cool TV to watch, and American Gods is back. I've gave a shout out to it last week, and the second episode was just as good as the first one. So definitely been enjoying that.
I definitely want to get caught up in that. And I know that, since you mentioned the Orville and we're talking about other sort of superhero shows, let me just say that Gotham is going out with a bang. It is not slowing down as it gets closer and closer to its end. It's just getting crazier and crazier. You know, it's just the idea of like, oh, well, there's so many Bat villains we haven't had a chance to introduce, and we've only got like 6 episodes left. Gotham goes, hold my beer, and introduces like 4 in one episode. It's mm-hmm. just, and yet it's all crazy and it's all cool. So I'm really digging Gotham. I'm going to miss the show when it's gone. It's just been a very, very crazy, crazy Elseworlds of the Batman universe.
And, yeah, I was going to say everything you know about the Bat universe, throw out.
Yeah, Well, don't throw out. You can enjoy because it's crazy. It's just a different take on it. So if you go in looking at it like an Elseworlds, I think you'll enjoy it a lot more. If you're stringent on who your Batman is and all that kind of stuff, you probably are going to be uncomfortable. But
exactly. If you're a purist, forget it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, can be said of so many things. But I definitely think that that's Gotham is one that it's great. It's just
exactly
my highlights of the week.
That's awesome. That is awesome that you're getting to do that and everything. So yeah, there's tons of, you know, springtime's not letting up, and you know, that's the great thing. We're winding up towards now, looking at the season finales probably in the next month or so. So
yeah, it's hard to believe, but it's right around the corner.
Exactly. So, you know, then we have fun summertime programming, but then again, April 14th is right around the corner and winter is coming. I know tomorrow's supposed to be the first day of spring, but winter is coming. So
yeah, it's crazy.
I know. And everyone's looking forward to that. HBO is looking forward to that. So it should be interesting to see what we got. And so we definitely, you know, got tons of good things going on.
I got a really quick question for you, because I was thinking about this the other day. And I know this could probably be our rants and raves for the whole like 15 minutes, but I have to ask. Okay. So we are, so 3 things are happening this year, right? We've got the end of Game of Thrones.
Yes.
We've got the end of the MCU as we know it. And true. We've got the
end. But I feel fine.
We've got the end of the Skywalker saga coming up.
Yes.
Which one of those are you most excited about? It's 3 big, major geek turning points, right?
Yes. That's a good question, because I think I'm probably most excited about the end of the Skywalker saga, because so many people were torn on the last episode of Star Wars, and I'm hoping JJ's return to it can help bring balance to the Force. See what I did there? And so, but yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I think because MCU is going to go on. So, well, technically Star Wars is also, but it's just not going to focus on the Skywalkers anymore. So I'm hoping, you know, but I think I'm looking forward to that the most, because Star Wars is something from my childhood that, you know, has always had a special place. And, you know, Game of Thrones, I need it to win me over again. It's been so long since we've seen anything from it. And I want to be engrossed with it again. And so I can be on the final episode just like, wow, you know, type of thing.
I'm going to cop out here and say, like, I can't decide. And I could give you an answer right now. I could say Skywalker Saga, right? But the fact is that after I saw that the end, when Captain Marvel was over, I couldn't wait for Endgame. When I saw the trailer for this season of Game of Thrones, I couldn't wait for Game of Thrones. I'm sure once we start seeing images and get excited about episode 9, I'm going to be like all giddy. So
I bet you 10 to 1 we're going to get the preview for episode 9 in front of Endgame.
That could be. I'm thinking that if they're going to air it, well, I don't know. I mean, a teaser anyway, right? A teaser would be, you're right, a teaser. And then maybe a full trailer when Star Wars Celebration happens in the next month or so after that, right? So so I would, because Celebration is going to give us something. So we at least need to get a title or something out of, you're right, probably something similar. But in any case, this is an exciting year. Just those three things alone, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. So, yeah, we are living in interesting geek times.
Yes, we are. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see. You know, it was interesting because Kevin Feige came out today, of all things, and he was talking about how they're breaking the different movie eras of the Marvel Universe. And basically, they're calling the first 10 years from Iron Man, the very first one, to the end of Endgame as one era, and they're calling it the Infinity Era. And so it's going to be interesting to see what the next era of Marvel is going to be like.
Doesn't Infinity imply that it goes on forever?
I know that.
It never ends.
This is Kevin Feige we're talking about, dude.
Look, they can... Like for 10 years, they've got this. I'm not worried about it. They've got this.
Of course. But, you know, it's interesting to see. And, you know, folks, we got a lot of good stuff coming up. And we're going to be sharing it all with you. But we want to hear from you. Please write us at earthstation1@esonetwork.com. Let's take a quick break. And we'll be back in a moment with the Geek Seat.
Hi, this is Ashley Pauls with this week's Box Office Buzz. This week, we've got a brand new horror film coming out from Jordan Peele called simply Us. It's about a family who is haunted by the feeling that something very bad is about to happen. After they spend a day at the beach, you know, just seems like a normal family-type vacation activity, they come home to their vacation home to find something truly horrifying. It's their own doppelganger staring back at them, and these doppelgangers haven't exactly come in peace. Now, I know I've mentioned in the past that I'm not much of a horror film fan, just not quite my jam, but I really, really loved Jordan Peele's Get Out. I thought this is a super thought-provoking and fascinating thriller that offered both scares and tackled some important issues that actually impact our society today. So, even though the trailer for Us actually looks scarier than Get Out, I still want to see it just because I loved what Jordan Peele did in Get Out so much. Although I have to admit, I'll probably wait for DVD for this one because I don't know if I can handle Us in a dark theater. Well, Us is undoubtedly going to be the most buzzworthy movie this weekend. We also have the rom-com Gloria Bell starring Julianne Moore, who finds love again. Then we also have Hotel Mumbai, about the 2008 siege of the Taj Hotel in India, which stars Dev Patel and Armie Hammer. And on DVD this week, I'm super excited because my favorite movie of 2018 is finally coming out on home video, and that's Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. If you have not seen this movie yet, you know what? There's no need to even rent it first. Just go out and buy it. It's such a wonderful film. I love the animation style. It's so colorful and unique, not like anything I've really seen in an animated movie before. And beyond that, just the characters are so wonderful. I have wanted to see Miles Morales' version of Spider-Man on screen for a while, and he's great. It's also wonderful to see all the other different kinds of spider people that come out of this multiverse. Just a really great film, so definitely be sure to check it out. Also worth checking out is Mary Poppins Returns, which is, of course, a very long-awaited sequel to Mary Poppins. Now, of course, this follow-up doesn't surpass the original. They rarely do, but it's still a very charming, fun family feel-good film with some nice songs. So definitely check that out. And that's it for this week. If you're looking for more entertainment-related content, be sure to check out my blog, boxofficebuzzab.wordpress.com. This week's topic is going to be the future of the two biggest superhero franchises, which is, of course, the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the DC Cinematic Universe.
Why should I listen to the Nerd Bliss podcast?
Because we go there.
Where?
Everywhere.
Human sexuality.
They don't care what's in your pants. They love you anyway.
Time travelers.
The problem is time will f*** back with you.
Politics and fandom.
What Star Wars has been prior to Disney. It is a white male-driven universe.
Find us at NerdBlissPodcast.com.
And on social media at NerdBlissPod. Part of this complete breakfast and the ESO Network.
The Nerd Bliss Podcast.
Listen!
Hey everyone, welcome back to Earth Station One. Now it's time for the Geek Seat segment, and we have a new friend of the show joining us. Welcome, Dan Kozu.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Welcome to the station. For those people who may not be familiar with your work, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I am a writer. I write primarily for the satire sites The Hard Times and The Hard Drive. I'm also a screenwriter and general writer, but I have my first novel coming out April 1st. It's called Lingeria, and it's available for pre-order. The ebook is 99 cents right now until April 1st. And yeah.
Excellent. Exciting.
Yeah.
Welcome to the wonderful, scary world of self-publishing.
It is terrifying, actually.
It really is. Well, tell us a little bit about, I guess we'll start with the novel that's coming out. What was the inspiration behind it?
Sure. It was originally going to be a cartoon pilot that I wrote, and then I decided that it was about an author, so I decided to turn it into a prose book. It's the first one I ever, long form that I ever attempted. And it was really, the book is about an author who is drawn into a portal that leads into the world of the successful fantasy series that he writes. And everybody there knows him and revere him as God, and his books are their Bible. I got the idea, it came actually from the Wizard of Oz series. If you read the later books, you can see L. Frank Baum gets a little tired of writing them, and he kind of bookends the books with these weird things where he's like, and Oz is invisible, and so I can never go there again, because he was so sick of writing the books. And then the beginning of the next book, you're like, oh, Dorothy was able to create a machine to call me, so that's why I'm able to write a new book. And so it was, I thought about an author who's sick of the world that he created, having to go into that world and deal with kind of the mess that he made.
Very, very, yeah. And it seems like it's got, from looking at the website and everything, it looks like it's got a sort of more of a satirical, like, is it fair to say? It looks a lot of fun. Is it an all ages book or?
There's bad language, okay. But there's nothing worse than bad language. There's some violence. Depending on where your qualms are, they swear a little bit, and there's some violence. There's not any sexual issues.
Gotcha. Well, I mean, I can tell you've already done your homework as a fantasy writer, because you've got a map and everything.
I made that map myself, so. but yeah, I just wanted to have fun with it, and I kind of broke it up into chapters, because I have a problem with kind of focusing, and that's why writing long form prose is kind of hard for me, and this was the challenge. And so I just kind of broke it up, and each chapter is kind of not an adventure. There is a linear plot, but that's how I was able to kind of confront it. And so I kind of went at it just having fun with it. And I just had a lot of fun, and hopefully the readers will see that as they go through it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, with a release date of April 1st, that makes me wonder if this is going to happen at all. No, just kidding.
I didn't realize that until I posted it and somebody said, is this a joke? Cause I didn't tell a lot of people about it because I abandon a lot of projects. And so I didn't want to be like, hey, I'm writing a book, and then nothing ever happens with it. So all of a sudden I just started telling people about it, and yeah.
Yeah, you're going to be announcing it on the first. Here's my book. Here's my book. And people are like, yeah, right. But anyway, it's perfect. So it sounds very exciting. So I would imagine, you probably have a personal history with a lot of fantasy. You mentioned Wizard of Oz. It seems like you're pretty familiar with those. Any other fantastical worlds that you visited?
Yeah, I mean, I love Lord of the Rings. I think the books are, and I wasn't too, like, I didn't read the books till I was probably in my early 30s, even after, like, the movies had come out. And because I actually wasn't a huge fan of the movies. I liked them, but then the expanded edition is actually what made me fall in love with.
Right.
I have like kind of my reading is kind of all over the place. I like a lot of sci-fi. I like a lot of fantasy. The Dragon Riders of Pern is a book series that I really like. The Dark Tower series, which I consider fantasy, is one of my favorite series. I didn't want to like kind of through like, what is it? Symbiosis. I didn't want to start stealing like how other people wrote. So I didn't read a lot of fantasy while I wrote this. I read like A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court is sort of that portal while I was writing this. So I kind of went all over the place while I was writing it because I didn't want to just steal too much from one source.
No, that's fair. It's not so much a commentary or a riff on one particular one. It's more like, yeah, that's because it's fair. And then there's so many. I mean, there's so many similarities, I think, and also so many differences. But kind of not a huge fantasy reader, but I am familiar with. I mean, I did read The Dragon Riders of Pern. Mm-hmm. I did read I read the Cliff Notes of Lord of the Rings. Literally, I got the Cliff Notes because a friend of mine was reading them and I kind of wanted to talk about it. He wanted to talk about it with me and I was like, this is a little heavy. I can't really get into it. So I bought the Cliff Notes so we were able to have a conversation about that.
Hey, anyway, and that's what I think. Like, if you don't like something, that's fine. I think to be a fan of a genre, you don't have to read everything in that genre. But I do like Terry Pratchett's Discworld. But I actually stopped reading it a while back when I started even like notes for this because I definitely didn't want this to feel like I was copying Pratchett or Douglas Adams for like a satirical book. And this isn't parody. I'm not parodying anything. This is it's more satire of, honestly, the book is more satire of current like nerd culture than fantasy writing books.
And in case I don't know if we've said it yet, the title is Lingeria. Is that right?
Characters in the book call it Lingeria. Other characters call it Lingeria. It's kind of a running joke throughout the book that everybody pronounces it kind of differently.
Gotcha. Okay, so we'll play.
I actually realized that after the second or third draft, when I started showing people and they started responding to me, and we were talking about it, I realized I never said it out loud, and I had no idea how. And then I realized. I was saying Lingeria, but a lot of people say Lingeria, and I really don't care. I think it's fun kind of however you see it. And it's the fun thing about being a reader that I love reading is that you pronounce words in your head, especially fantasy words, totally different than everybody else.
It's kind of like Mixoplex or something like that.
I also love the fact that it's book one of one so far, you know.
Yeah.
hopefully it'll prove to be, you know, so successful that you'll have book two of one.
I do have an idea for book two of one, but I actually have, I think, two other, assuming I can convince myself to keep going, two other books that have nothing to do with this. Because a lot of the book is about hating your own creation, and I don't want to burn out on this So I do have two other completely different things that I'm working on.
Well, you mentioned at the top of the segment that screenwriter, you're also writing for satire sites. As far as inspirational writers, other authors out there that you find inspiration from, who would you name as being key influences for you?
I do love L. Frank Baum's writing. I think it's a very, for writing children's books, it's actually very, he loves language. And so I love his books. I'm kind of all over the place. Thomas Hardy is one of my favorite authors of all time. And he writes like European or British, not romance, tragedies, really. I'm trying to think. Of course, proper names are eluding me right now. I do like a lot of Stephen King's work, but not, I actually like his non-horror stuff. His more like, I don't think The Stand is horror. I think it's more fantasy. Dark Tower is more fantasy.
Sure.
I love George Orwell's works. I'm blanking on Ender's Game author who he's problematic for his personality, but I actually love his writing.
Is that, Scott Card?
Yeah. Orson Scott Card. Which it's weird because if you read about his personality, you're like, but he writes the complete opposite. Like the themes of his work are everything that he seems to stand against, which is really weird. I don't know if you know the author Robert R. McCammon. He's another kind of all over the place writer. He writes fantasy and horror and kind of all in between. But he wrote a book called Boy's Life, which is probably my favorite book of all time. And so he's just amazing. I really love his work.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, speaking of influences and geeking out, Mike, I think he's ready for to be seated in the chair.
Ooh.
Yes. He has been waiting. It's been a little bit lonely the last few weeks. So
and we were out of town. So
yeah, exactly. Please take a seat, relax, and Mike will slowly and gently tie you down. Yeah, right.
It's harder. Right, than I was picturing a comfier chair. This is very firm.
most people do.
Exactly. Many have cried in that seat. So, you know, that's why we have the tissues right next to it. It's okay.
We're perfectly fine letting people think that.
Exactly. You know, the more comfy it gets for you, the more comfortable you get. And then we lay the boom of the geek seat on you. Are you ready for your first question, sir?
Bring it on.
He's too happy. Mike, tighten him up.
I'm just saying, I'm like, man, they always start out so cocky. I know.
Bring it on. Let's go. Yeah. What was your favorite geek out moment?
I wrote an article for the Hard Times about Weird Al, and it gained a little traction, and he actually ended up liking it and sharing it on Twitter. And that I probably lost my mind more that day than I ever have before, even though I haven't met him in person or anything. It was just like, he didn't know I wrote it. He just shared an article that I wrote, but he was such an influence of me coming up as a comedy writer and just as a kid and a music lover as well, that I lost my mind knowing that he had read something that I had written. And enjoyed it and didn't think I was being mean or disrespectful in any way.
That's awesome.
That is awesome.
Yeah. We are big Al fans here. So,
yes. Oh, yeah. And when we say big, we just mean big, large, heavy, you know. So that is pretty darn awesome. Mm-hmm. What was your most disappointing geek out moment?
I think when they announced the female Doctor Who, like literally just the teaser where like she took the hood off and the internet it's not all the internet. Actually, I think probably most of the fans were like, okay, let's wait and see. But you instantly had to defend it, and there was no reason to have to defend it just based on, and I just wanted to geek out that more Doctor Who was coming and that it was going to be a new actor with a kind of I loved Capaldi, but with like kind of a new twist on it. You didn't know where it was going to go and a new showrunner, and without even a trailer or anything, it was already hatred, and you had to get out there and defend it instantly. And it was just like, I just want to have fun with this. Like, and it was just really hard to do it. And it was just disappointing how the geek culture that I kind of grew up in, which probably wasn't really, I'm probably thinking nostalgically, but was inclusion. And was that we were the people that were picked on and we found something. And when that happened, I was just like, this isn't fun. This isn't what it's supposed to be. So I think that was the most disappointing geek out moment for me.
No, totally understand that. What geeks you out the most?
I think meeting other geeks, like who find, like who love the esoteric stuff that I love. I'm a big fan of the British show, The Prisoner, from like the 60s. And I recently met somebody who was also a huge fan of it. And like, and when you find those people randomly, like not in like the sub forums or something, but in just meeting them and you can talk about the show and just lose your minds over it for a while and love the same thing. I love those moments where you just bond over something instantaneously that you both cherish so much.
My brothers, my sisters, we have something.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, you've heard of this too. I can't believe you've heard of this.
Oh my God. You know that? I love you. Feel like Doug from Up, you know? I just met you, but I love you. What turns your geek off?
I think going back to like the Doctor Who thing, just hate. I don't think there's any reason to just, like, you can not like something. That's fine. Like, if you didn't like a movie and you're like, oh, I didn't particularly like that movie, or I really didn't like that movie for what, like how they did. But to feel like you need to define yourself by your hatred of something is just like, it just turns me off. Like you have no reason to be doing this. Go to that thing that you love and promote that and get people to hear about that. Don't spend your time. Like, you hated The Last Jedi. That's fine. Like, but to like attack people who actually enjoyed it. I mean, I don't see the joy in that. I don't see the reverie in that and the community in that. So I think that's what turns me off and like makes me want to just quit the internet basically.
No, totally. You're not the only one on that one. Mm-hmm. And we also saw that with a lot with Captain Marvel.
Well, yeah. And I wasn't, I walked out. I'm like, yeah, that was a movie. Like I wasn't like, but I saw a lot of my friends posting online how much they love, like they loved her and certain parts that like reminded them of their upbringing and things like that. And I'm like, good, celebrate it. I'm not going to be the one to take it away from you.
That's awesome. You had friends who were captured by aliens?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, that's awesome.
They thought they were aliens. It turned out they were human. It was crazy.
Oh, God. You know, I hate when that happens. Usually I just call that Tuesday. It's cool.
Yeah.
What fictional character would you like to meet the most?
The Doctor, 100%. I'm a huge Doctor Who fan. And it's one of the few characters in, like, in storytelling that's typically an optimist, usually, and especially in today's kind of storytelling, the main character is usually flawed, usually pessimistic. Like, that's just kind of the character we like. We like the kind of edgy bad guy. And there's just something about optimism in the Doctor that I need in my life because I'm the pessimist and I'm the downhearted one. And like the use of nonviolence and just, it's just so opposite of everything we kind of love as a culture, but it's still amazing. And so I think to meet and to travel with a being like that would, I think I would probably get annoyed at first because it's not who I am, but my God, I would just love to travel the universe with the Doctor.
No, totally understand that completely. Who was your first Doctor?
It was Eccleston, because we got it on PBS and I'm like, I kind of like, I remember the Tom Baker kind of Simpsons jokes and his kind of, like his name was in the ether is what Doctor Who was, but I didn't know too much about it. But when they started playing it on PBS, they would play it, I think around like Monty Python and, Fawlty Tower episodes. And it was during like the Bad Wolf time and it was amazing. And so I was hooked instantaneously when Eccleston was on.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. What fictional character would you not like to meet?
Dolores Umbridge from Harry Potter, 100%. Like, I didn't even need to think about that. Like, I hate her more than Voldemort. It's just such a perfectly, in the book, I've only read, I think through her book. I don't think I've read past that, but in the movies, it's such a perfectly created character for propaganda and for just awful character, because Voldemort's evil, but she's pushing a message I can't even watch movies with that actress in it anymore because it upsets me so much.
Wow. Wow. Okay. nothing like strong feelings on the show tonight. That's good. That
is, but if you like the Lower Sunbridge, I'm not hating on you. Sorry, didn't mean to do that. Going against my own beliefs, sir, about hate.
It's okay. You know, many people have their opinion and, you know, they just feel pity for you since you're in the geek seat, so it's okay. What is your favorite geek word, phrase, quote, or pose?
I wrote this one down and then thought about it and thought about it. I'm like, is there something else that I like say or something? Like, and but it, I stuck with, I have been and always shall be your friend. Spock's last words in A Wrath of Khan. Spoilers. Yeah. I said spoilers at the wrong thing.
That's, yeah, I know. You're spoiling something that's almost 40 years
yeah,
old. That's
okay. All. But that line just defines him and Kirk so perfectly. And it's not about the Federation anymore. It's not about the wars. It's not. It's about the two of them. And it breaks my heart every time I've seen that movie. I can't tell you how many times.
Spock. Spock. We actually just reviewed it for the ESO Network Riffs.
Oh, really?
We did a riff of Wrath of Khan, and it's available actually to our patrons.
Fantastic. So,
yep.
Everybody should watch that movie.
Oh, it is such a fabulous movie. Mm-hmm. It's one of Mike Gordon's favorites.
Absolutely.
So, oh, really?
Exactly. Yeah. Mike, tighten the ropes. He's too chatty.
Well, he does have to breathe a little bit.
No. No.
Okay.
Where's the fun? If he doesn't turn purple, where is the good times, you know? All right. What is your ideal geek occupation?
I didn't know if this was supposed to be an occupation in a fictional world, like in the geek realm, like Ensign on the Enterprise or something, or in the geekdom that we live in. And so I put on doing it, storytelling. Like, it's what I've always dreamed of doing and what I am doing. I hope to do it full time and not have a day job one day. But even having a day job, I'm loving it. And it's what I've always wanted to do. And I'm so glad I get to.
No, totally understand that. Definitely understand that one. Because, you know, that's our number one answer is when the person is already doing what their favorite geek occupation is doing. But let's look at the flip side of that one. What geek occupation would you not like to do?
I would say Reddit forum moderator for any specific geek genre. I can't imagine what they go through and the like kind of vitriol they have to kind of comb through and delete. I would never do that.
It's a good answer. I'm surprised that hasn't come up before. Very good.
Yeah, that is awesome, actually. Wow. Yeah. You know, it sucks whoever has to moderate any kind of group. I feel bad for people who have to do that. Except for the ESO network group. You know, we love you guys. We just totally love you guys. It's okay.
Nothing but good people.
Exactly. All great people out there. All right, Dan, are you ready for your final question in the geek seat?
I need to get out of this chair. It's getting itchy.
That's why, because we have ants sitting on it now.
Oh,
see, you thought those were little, that was just your limbs going numb. No. We released 24 fire ants onto it. It's perfect. So, all right. Your final question in the geek seat is, what is your ultimate geek fantasy?
I think it would be, there's kind of a little bit of a story behind this, but me and my friend were writing a cartoon. And we're like, what is the goal of this? And I said, I want to see somebody dress up as one of our characters one day. Like that, I don't care if people hate it. Like if 99% of the public hates it and 1% loves it, and somebody like, and I think that's my ultimate geek fantasy, is to one day somebody cosplay as a character I created. I think I will lose my mind if that happens. And I'm not asking anybody to do it because that will seem forced. But I will lose my mind that I could inspire somebody to love something so much to dress up as a character.
Oh, that's cool. All right. I can see that.
Absolutely. It is a truly wondrous feeling.
Oh, yeah. Well, Dan, your answer was good, but I do have some news for you.
Oh, no.
Congratulations, sir. You have made it through the geek scene.
Yes. I didn't think. Woo-hoo! I really thought I was going to lose my mind there for a while.
Mr. Mike Gordon, tell the young man what he's won.
You have won a lifetime subscription to the ESO Network, a value easily worth $87.04.
Hey, I, honestly,
it's we don't lie, sir.
That's fantastic. No, thank you. I love your never lied. I love your shows, and that's why I reached out to you guys because I really enjoy your content.
So we've never lied on this podcast at all. Nope, never.
No, only, well, we might have kind of stretched the truth when we said we were going to get you out of the chair. You're in it for good. In the meantime, where can people go to find out more about your work and your new novel?
Sure. You can pre-order the novel on Amazon. It's Lingeria. I would suggest writing Lingeria book because lingerie will show up if you just write Lingeria.
Hey, now.
You could also find me and my book. I am at K0ZUH on all the social media, and the book is at Lingeria Book on all the social media.
Awesome. And we will have links to all of that in our show notes. Dan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Absolutely.
That's awesome, man. It's good to have you here. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be back in a moment when we go up to South Carolina Comic-Con and talk to Kevin Eastman.
Hey, everybody. Michelle here with the Iconic Rock Talk Show Moment. We are getting closer and closer to the induction ceremony for the 2019 class for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It is the time of the season. Yeah, see what I did there. This past week, the hall announced the inductors or presenters for that class and got some very exciting matchups and I think a couple of tasters for names that we will see again in October when they announce the ballot for the 2020 class. Harry Styles will be inducting Stevie Nicks. Trent Reznor will induct The Cure. Trent is way overdue, multiple nominee. I think we'll definitely see him on the ballot, and it will be his time this time around. Roxy Music will be inducted by Simon Le Bon and John Taylor of Duran Duran. I think Duran Duran will also be on the ballot. Brian May will induct his buddies in Def Leppard. Janelle Monáe is doing the honors for Janet Jackson, and it's just so exciting to have Janelle Monáe. As of right now, Janet is not confirmed to perform. Hopefully that will change. But if she does not, and Janelle Monáe performs something, that will be incredible. And in a perfect world, if it could possibly happen, Janelle Monáe and Janet Jackson together, and then, folks, we just all can't even. So looking excited to see what happens there. David Byrne will be presenting for Radiohead. And one that was kind of a surprise to me, Susanna Hoffs of the Bangles will be presenting for the Zombies. The ceremony itself is March 29th at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. And then the HBO telecast will be April 27th. And in movie news, Rudy Dolezal, who has done a lot of video and film work for a lot of stars. He did a lot of work with Queen back in the day. He says that a sequel to Bohemian Rhapsody is being seriously discussed within the Queen family. No. Brian May and Roger, I have loved you for a long time, but no. If a sequel were to happen, I'm sorry. That's just greed there. You cannot play with the timeline the way you did for Bohemian Rhapsody to make that story arc and then have a sequel. You can't have it both ways, guys. So just say no. No, 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 no. This is Michelle with the Iconic Rock Talk Show Moment. Check out the blog. I've got a little blurb about Glastonbury on there for this year. iconicrocktalkshow.wordpress.com. And I will see you next week when I will still be going, no, 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 no.
Did you know the ESO Network has a brand new Patreon? That's right. We're asking for your help, and you could do it for as little as $1 a month. Don't fret, all your favorite shows will still be available for free as always, but now you can get exclusive podcasts and more not heard anywhere else but on our Patreon. To sign up for the ESO Network Patreon's easy. All you have to do is click on the link on the top navigation of the ESO Network website or go to patreon.com/ESO Network. With your support of the ESO Network, it's you who will reap the rewards.
If anyone wants to move forward, you can. Phil, definitely come on, fill the first couple rows. And if you anyone wants to ask questions to Kevin, please line up at the microphone. Because that's how we'll be doing questions, so that way everybody can hear you guys.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Only give yes or no answers, that's it.
Okay. So, rapid succession.
Yes,
exactly.
Yes, oh, yes.
Yes, the...
So while everybody's getting situated, I guess we'll get us started. I want to start right from the beginning. I guess we're talking about 1983, 84, right? Is that, if you want to go back further, you can. I'm curious. Okay, so you and Peter are sitting around wondering, like, or trying to figure out what you're going to do, what project you're going to do, and how. Like, how did you develop the turtle? When did you know that the turtles was the thing to move ahead with?
Well, the whole thing was completely accidental in many ways, and actually many, many ways. But Pete and I had formed a company called Mirage Studios, and it was a Mirage because it was actually our living room. And we had this... Pete and his wife Janine were renting a house in Dover, New Hampshire, and they had a spare room, and I was cooking lobsters... Maine accent comes right back when you say lobsters. Lobsters up in the...
The lobsters up there.
Up in the harbor.
It's wicked cool.
It was wicked cool.
Wicked chowder.
My chowder. Chowder. So I finished work that summer cooking lobsters, and he said, hey, you know, we'd already met before, and because we were... I met him, actually. Take a step back. I met him. I was trying to sell some of my cartoons to this magazine that I found on the bus between Amherst and Northampton, Massachusetts.
Sure.
And it's called Scat. And I took it. I gathered my portfolio, went to the Scat offices and tried to sell them some of my jokes and some of my cartoons. And they said, well, we don't really do the kind of work you're doing, but you should meet this guy, Peter Laird. He's another local artist that draws the same, you know, weird stuff you do. And so I wrote Peter a letter, and back when you did those things back in those days. And
Before emails.
Before emails.
Before text.
You actually put stuff on paper? Wow.
And a stamp.
Oh, yeah, whoa.
By myself. And no, but it was... So we hit it off right away over... the first time I went to Pete's studio, he had a pencil page from Jack Kirby, and I just lost my mind. I was a huge Jack Kirby fan, and I'd never seen the Jack Kirby original, so it was quite incredible. He gave it to me years later. We still have it in our collection at home. So we bonded, and we started trading ideas, and then I finished... I was doing part-time school down in there, and I moved back to Maine, and I was cooking lobsters over the summer, and just coincidentally, Pete moved 20 minutes from where I was working in Maine into New Hampshire. And so he would come up, and we'd noodle and doodle around. We said, well, let's form a studio and see if we can get some work. So what we accomplished was getting a lot of rejection letters, which was awesome, but inspiring. We put them up on the wall for inspiration. And it was probably November of 1983. It was actually November of 1983 that I was just annoying Pete one night, and I was thinking to myself, what's the stupidest thing I could come up with? How about Bruce Lee as an animal? What would be the dumbest animal he'd be? And so I did this first sketch, which is on our hat here, of a turtle standing upright. He had his mask on and nunchucks, and I put it on his table. I said, this is going to be the next big thing. Ha, ha, ha. I was joking.
Somebody was listening.
So he did a sketch and changed some things, and I thought to myself, well, if one, why not a group of them? So I did a sketch in pencil of four turtles, each with a different weapon, and I wrote in, you know, comic booky, you know, Ninja Turtles on it. And when he inked it in, he had a Teenage Mutant to the title. And we looked at this and said, this is the dumbest thing we've ever seen. We immediately said, we have to come up with a story that tells how these characters got to be the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And that was November of 83 when that happened. And then by January of 84, we started working on the comic book and completed it by May.
It's a pretty fast turnaround.
Yeah. As we joke, we didn't have any distracting pain work going on, so it was...
When you created the first comic, did you just do, like, oh, it's going to be a one-and-done type thing?
Or? Oh, yes. Yeah, it was, you know, I can't compliment my uncle enough in that he loaned us the money. He was our early form of crowdfunding, because he believed we had to borrow the money to actually print the book. Sure. We did this full budget. We got our print quotes. We put together an advertising plan, how to sell them through the mail, how we'd pay him back within the next 60 or 70 years. So we ended up to print exactly 3,000 copies, and it was one of those things that we said, well, if we sell a couple hundred, you know, that would be awesome. And
that's when went from there.
It just started selling, and it's all your fault, by the way. Thank you, by the way, for buying those back in those days.
Your uncle's like, I should have asked for a cut.
I'm sure he was well compensated.
We sorted him out. Yeah, yeah. We took good care of him. But it was great. He was at, so we printed 3,000 copies, and I went back to Cooking Lobsters for that summer. And throughout the summer, we sold out of the 3,000 copies, and we did another printing of 6,000 copies. And then by the time I finished work that fall, you know, because Pete and I talked pretty much every day, and he said, well, people keep calling and asking when we're going to do a second issue. And we were like, we never thought the first issue would sell enough to warrant a second issue. So in fall of 84, we started working on issue two.
That was awesome.
Wow, it's a great story. I'm a New England boy, Massachusetts, New Hampshire border. I'm an independent creator, and you're like, you guys are, you and Ben, you know, the creator of The Tick, you guys are like legends to us.
You know, Ben, I love Ben. Ben's doing quite well for himself. He's like Gotham, one of the main.
Yeah, I think, he's been doing TV work mostly the last, and I think, well,
ask him for a cut.
And he's got the Tick series on Amazon.
That's right.
In charge of that too. So,
man, I love the original because my wife Courtney and I for about 6 or 7 years we'd watch Rules of Engagement nightly before we crashed out. But I love Patrick Warburton's The Tick.
It was too short lived,
but it was an awesome series.
Just the voice, even when I see him on anything else, Tick.
Yeah.
Awesome. We got questions?
If you got questions,
first of all,
pop in line.
This line is a whole lot shorter than the one I talked to you yesterday. So that's awesome.
I talk too much anyway.
Second of all, you guys kind of stomped all over this, but my question was, what was the first thing that your Uncle Clinton said to you when this first took off?
I want a cut. No, he was great. You know, it's funny because his mom, my grandmother was a painter, so she was a big inspiration. My artistic talent was definitely inherited. My father used to doodle a lot, and his brothers and stuff. And Quentin at the time was selling art supplies, a company called Charpak, and so I used to get discounts for all my art supplies from him. But he was just super supportive, and just thought, you know, this is an interesting idea. And he was aware, you know, of comics, and he was on a, you know, serious comic reader or collector, but he was aware of what was going on and just thought it was kind of cool and thought, you know, and I mean, we did. We invited him over to the house, we scheduled a meeting, and we had this full business plan. So it was, you know, we weren't just saying, hey, dude, can you loan us some money? And we said, this is how we'll pay you back.
That was really...
That was great, apparently.
Yeah, it was really... I mean, in early 80s, that was really risky, too. I mean, to even have an idea of getting your money back, let alone... reaching the kind of success that you did. The fact that, you know, when I ask for support, I mean, thanks to you, people can go, oh yeah, that did happen a couple times. But back then, it wasn't happening.
No, we were very...
A lot of people must have told you, like, no.
Well, no, you know, what was interesting, that was, he's, you know, fortunately, he was the only one that we really asked, but he helped us right away. But it was a very interesting time in comics in that, you know, because we had a lot of models that we were looking at, and some of the stuff that was actually working. Things like Dave Sim did a comic called Cerebus, the Aardvark, which was started in, I think, mid 70s, And he was having some success with that, and Wendy and Richard Pini with a book called ElfQuest, which was really, really popular.
Amazing stuff.
Flaming Carrot was, I think, another one out there around that time. And Bob. And Bob. You remember Bob?
Yeah.
Yeah, we were out of the Atlanta area, so yeah.
Bob pops up all the time.
I thought he slept at your house or something. No, I love Bob. It's like he's... He's
Let
one
me
of
tell
fun
you about Mystery Men. I can tell you all about that.
I love that movie, by the way. It was one of those, like, that Mystery Men movie was fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
But there was, even a bit further, even my dad was, familiar. He was a big fan of the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers. And so I was sort of tuned into, underground comics and self-publishers, but it was really kind of Dave Sim and this new group of Sim as a self-publisher and creator owner, and Wendy and Richard Pini and all that stuff. That was really, that was in my, my wheelhouse as far as my age group. And you could see the possibility, well, these guys are doing it, so maybe, just maybe. So
they were totally paving the way for you, and they were your inspiration more for it.
Yep.
Not going off the Superman, Batman, DC, Marvel.
Totally.
And everything.
Yeah, because it's funny because in many ways Heavy Metal Magazine led me to a lot of these guys in that the early issues of Heavy Metal Magazine that came out in 1977. Some of those issues had original works by Vaughn Bode and Richard Corbin and things like that, and I became infatuated with, not only heavy metal, but those artists in particular. And again, growing up in Maine, we would make on a day off, a buddy of mine that read comics would make a pilgrimage down to Million Year Picnic, which was in central Boston. And that was, they had this huge selection of underground comic books, and that's where we found like Cerebus and some of these guys. And we were just like, and even then it was in the world of comics, they had the direct market distribution, which was a non-returnable system. Like most Marvel and DC, as you guys all know, it's like it was, they ship them to those spinner racks and grocery stores and drug stores, and they were all returnable, which isn't economically feasible to a lot of self-publishers. But the direct comic market was something you could solicit for your books, they'd place orders.
But this was also the era of local comic book distributors, because you didn't have Diamond being the monopoly like it is nowadays. So you probably had to contact each one of them to try to get your comic to them.
And it's too bad, and I'm glad you brought that up, because it's really sad that that whole system went away. When we did distribution on Turtles, like, reprint of 1 and 2 and 3, there was about 26 small distributors from Heroes World, Sunrise, Capital Comics. There was a lot of these guys that made it to the ship and distribute. Similar to what they were doing, a lot of record, they distribute records.
That's
and
true.
Vinyl and all kinds of interesting.
All the different labels and such.
Yeah, so that was, and then when Diamond really messed things up.
The attack of Steve Jepper.
attack of Steve Jepper.
We got a question out there.
Yes, sir.
You talked about your initial distribution attempts, that first run of 3,000. What's the most you've seen one of those, that initial run, go for compared to what you initially sold it for?
Well, it's funny because we were selling them $1.50 plus 50 cents postage back then. I've seen it varied. I think like crazy varied in that. I think there was a 9.4, 9.6 a couple years ago that went almost for $20,000, which I think was exceptionally, and I've never seen that again. Most of the ones we've seen, because even the quality of the books, the printer that we were working with in New Hampshire, it was so small, and it was this really cheap newsprint, and really everything was really cheap. The newsprint started yellowing while it was still on press, practically. Some of them are cropped really weird and stuff. So it's to get see a really nice version, but I think the average around 5,000. I think.
And you don't see a dime.
No. I don't see a dime. No, it's
not one of those.
No, actually, I sold my interest in the Turtles probably 20 years ago, and. That's interesting because I sold my interest initially to Pete, and then Pete sold it to Viacom, and then when Viacom started relaunching the Turtles, they basically called me, and so I ended up being brought back into the world of Turtles, and what an incredible blessing it's been. It's just been, I probably had as much fun, like I mainly work on the IDW comic series right now, and I have as much fun, it's almost as much fun as I did originally working with Peter, because I get to work with guys like Tom Waltz and And that comic story is the closest you probably ever get to the original Mirage series, in that it's tonally intended for an older audience, so it's got a bit more of an edge to it and things like that. And we're going to be hitting issue 100 November. Thank you guys again. Thank you.
It was interesting because when you started your comic, it was a very adult theme.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they announced that, you know, they're going to make a cartoon out of it, it was like they almost Disneyfied it in a lot of ways. And what was your reaction to that type of, other than, oh, bring me the money.
Making it rain. one of the things is, it's a great question because, you know, Peter and I were, again, huge, both huge fans of Jack Kirby and you know, Siegel and Schuster and Steve Gerber and so many of these guys that, I mean, Jack Kirby in particular created most of the Marvel Universe that even Stan Lee takes credit for. Rest in peace, Stan. But it was like, but that was the nature of the business. A lot of those guys worked for Work for Hire. So all those ideas that they came up with owned by the company. So a brilliant guy like Jack Kirby, who created, you know, again, the Fantastic Four and Spider-Man and some of the things, when the company saw success from those things, those creations, he didn't see a penny from those. And so Peter and I knew very early on, we had a clear understanding of that. I mean, even around this time, there was a big industry fight. Guys like Frank Miller and Gary Groth, who published the Comics Journal, and a lot of Mike Kaluta and Bernie Wrightson were really petitioning hard for creators' rights. The ownership were not only what they created for these companies. Swamp Thing, Len Wein, that was something they created that DC ended up owning. Many more stories. And a lot of times they wouldn't even get their artwork back, their original artwork that was back in those days. So it was a big fight to get Jack Kirby's artwork back. So as we went into the animated opportunities with the Turtles, we owned our copyright, we owned our trademark. We were selling probably about 60 or 70,000 copies of a black and white comic book. So we not only could pay our rent, eat, and put a little money in the bank, it made us exceptionally protective and probably even cocky, in that when Hollywood approached, and there were a few different agents that approached us initially and said, we think this can be toys, we think it can be something much more than a comic book, and we were like, it's a comic book, and you know, this is what it was intended to be, and we don't see what you see in it. And besides, you know, at least the first two agents that approached us, we thought they were untrustworthy. I'm trying to be wicked polite here.
I'm impressed you were able to do that.
Yeah, I was like, you know, bleep, 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 agents. But we met this guy, Mark Friedman, who approached us, and he was the same kind of thing. He showed up in our offices in Northampton, Massachusetts, in his $800 suit, perfect hair, you know, this thing. And he's like, you know, I think it could be this, I could be this. And we were like, dude, all right, at least you're more tolerable than most of the rest of the guys that we've talked to. And I tell you what, we'll give you 30 days, no obligation. If you come to us with some kind of interesting opportunity for us to discuss, then we'll continue talking to you. But the parameters are, we own it, we control it, we have full and final say in everything that's done with it, period. Or we don't need to talk to you anymore. And so he came back with Playmates Toys and an animation company, and it was as such. So Peter and I had not only complete say and involvement, it was Peter's idea, which I thought was a great idea, to change the color, the red bandanas to the different color bandanas, so you could tell them apart more easily as a cartoon, as a toy character. We worked on all the original, we worked on all 300 original cartoon shows. We had final say in all the scripts, all the notes, all the design work, everything that you saw with a turtle on it for probably the first 15 years of Turtles, we had full and final say. And so we knew that we were going into the animated series. Our black and white comics were written for an older audience. We knew specifically this was being done for a 4 to 6 year old audience.
So. Sure. No, I totally understand that, because I was talking to Rob Paulson, and
love
he
Rob.
Could not say enough great things about you guys.
Oh, that's awesome.
And, you know, just working with you guys on the original cartoon series. And now he's involved with it again. So, and he's just like, the Turtles, it's just like, this is my life in a lot of ways.
No, Rob's, with that original crew, we actually, Courtney and I have done a couple events, conventions with, and it's funny, if you've ever met Rob, who is the nicest guy ever, and but when you get Townsend Coleman and Cam Kennedy and Barry and all the original cast of the Turtles at a show, it's like the Three Stooges times 10. They're very funny together, and they act out these whole scenes, and they do these little quartet, you know, the singing things, and that's an absolute ride. And it was great, and I love that when Nickelodeon came back around to do the 2012 series, that they did bring Rob back specifically, and he wasn't Raphael like he was in the first one. They gave him Donatello, and it was really that one.
Exactly. So. Two sides of his personality right there.
Yeah. Actually, there's a funny, I don't know if you guys knew this, is a funny factoid is, you guys know Chuck Lorre? Chuck Lorre.
Yeah.
He wrote the theme song for the Turtles.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
You know, for years I've forgotten because, you know, again, back in those days they had sent us all these cassette tapes of the theme songs, and the one that we picked out, which became the theme song. It was like years later when he became hugely successful with Two and a Half Men and Big Bang, and people like, well, you know, Chuck wrote the theme song for Turtles, the Turtles cartoon. And I was like, what? No way. I completely forgotten. And then Courtney, we were invited to a taping. Courtney and I got to not only sit in Sheldon's spot, not at the same time, separately.
So you got to sit on the couch.
We get to sit on the couch, and we get to meet Chuck Lorre. And he was fantastic. Because he came up and he said, we met Chuck's daughter who had said that Chuck basically said, he said, I was a hero to my child when she was in, you know, going through elementary school and things like that, because I wrote the Turtles theme song, so that was my claim to fame back then.
That is awesome.
So I said, now I want a cut of your career, Chuck. He said no.
Do you guys have more questions?
This is a bit of a fanboy question, but I've had this argument with a lot of people. Are the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles superheroes or not?
Are they superheroes or not?
Yes.
They're, you know what I loved about comics when I was reading, the comics, the kind of comics I was reading when I was growing up were like Spider-Man, for example, and I guess I'd say my point of Spider-Man in particular, because he was more of a reluctant superhero. It was sort of like he got bit by the spider, he became this, obtained these amazing mutant powers, and then, you know, when the forces of evil sort of, you know, cropped up and needed to be dealt with, he took it on upon himself to be that hero, I think, which we all want to be. And, you know, we want to be that Indiana Jones. We want to be that hero, but when it steps in and saves the day. And so I felt like that was how we modeled the Turtles. Is like they, I was like that they were intended to be sort of teenagers first, and, you know, they, you know, but when they need to, they do the right thing and they step up. So I'd say superheroes, yes, but reluctant ones. I'd rather be playing video games or Fortnite or something. Sneaking into movies.
Sitting around eating pizza.
Exactly.
Over the years, of course, you know, there's been waves of movies and many animated series, comics, etc. Do you see, have you noticed any sort of pattern over the course of all these years with, you know, sometimes the turtles go die down a little bit, they're down on the roller coaster, and then they go back up?
Yeah, no, that's that was what was amazing too, is you know, when you think about this is our 35th anniversary, this May will be officially 35 years.
Wow.
From first publication. Yeah, all your fault again. thank you.
35 years, makes me issue feel 100 old. Is coming up. I think there's some big celebrating happening.
let me adjust my depends first. But it's been a wonderful ride and a wonderful blessing in every imaginable sense of the word. But our agent, the agent that took it out initially, he said no. Because he was great, he always had lots of great advice. And he said, "Look, this is most boys' concepts of this type. You'll have an introductory year. You don't really make any money. You get, you know, paid a little bit to advances for the rights. But he said, if it works, you'll have a second year, which would be the banner year, which you could potentially make some pretty good money. And then by year three, you're in the discount bins. So he said, you know, save everything. And he said, you know, talk to a financial person and." You know, just make sure you take care of yourself first, the best you can, and then, you know, that just didn't stop for a long time. I'd say the peak year being, you know, probably 89 and 90 with the movie. Yeah, the first movie was a huge hit, you know, that was another interesting, just as a digression, was like every studio in Hollywood said no to the movie. They were like, we're not are you guys drunk? Mutant turtles? And what?
Well, the concept alone, I would imagine, looking at it, like, well, in order to pull this off, it's going to cost a lot.
Yes, it was definitely, it was a bunch of that, but we were blessed in so many ways that not only New Line Cinema saw the opportunity to invest in it, but distribution, but Golden Harvest, the main parent company that did the film, did all the Jackie Chan films, and had seen, you know, it's like, oh, okay, we can put a martial artist in a rubber suit and get away with some of this. But Steve Barron, the director they brought in, had worked with Jim Henson on some Storyteller episodes and some other things, and so he had a great knowledge of animatronics and what could be done and what couldn't be done. So that perfect storm of all those things coming together was, you know, how they squeezed, I think the total budget was around $7 million, which is, you know, for 19, that was a lot.
Oh, that back
then. Now it's like you can't shoot a Pepsi commercial with that. But no, it was, but that was, you know, it was a true independent movie, and then the way that it was done, the way that it was handled, and I think that's why, in many ways, it came up as good as it did, because that will always be out of, going back to your question, is that there have been many versions, and, you know, the peaks were probably 91, 92, and then there was a sort of steadily, we had a presence in cartoons and stuff until 1996 into 97, when I did, Pete took a short break when I worked on the live action series, which introduced Venus, which I know everybody loves as much as I do. I do. And then I stepped away from the Turtles when Pete came in and did the 2000 series, which is also one of my favorites. I think that series was, and that's what, oddly enough, that's what Tom and I refer to a lot, that 2000 series as part of some of the basis for the IDW comics that we're doing. But yeah, we've seen it sort of peaks and valleys, of course, and then the fact that, you know, you know, every time it would be reintroduced, and going back to the most recent reintroduction has been the most mind-blowing, in that most of you folks that were fans of the original series, say you were 7, 8, 9 when it first came out, we do shows now, Courtney and I do about 15 shows a year, and we now see like whole families coming dressed as Turtles or fans of Turtles, that, you know, because I always say that the biggest compliment of the huge, it is very humbling in its sense, is that you can't tell kids what's cool and what's not cool. They decide. And the fact that kids have found something after all these years in the Turtles that's sort of, you know, what? I don't know. It's amazing. And that's so that's pretty thrilling. It's, you know, as popular today as it's ever been.
Well, it's awesome probably for you to see, like, variations of the very first storylines that you guys came up with up on the big screen, either in cartoon or in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And just, that's my work. And it just probably geek out for you than anything.
Yep. No, it's still, it's like, you know, because we've seen, you know, because people ask, like, okay, what's your favorite Turtle movie and what's your least favorite? And you guys probably know the answer. In some respect, no. But the one of the things I like, even there may be some of the Turtle version of the Turtles that I might like a little less than others, or others I might like a little more than others. What's been so awesome is that the consistency of what I guess Pete and I evolved the series to by, say, issue 11 and 12, which we only did, you know, full on like 15-16 issues together, where we passed pages back and forth and wrote the stories, and then there was always a smattering of working together in different aspects, was the idea that the Turtles were a family. And it's like four, you know, mutated characters that are basically orphaned. They have a surrogate father and a mutated rat. That's funny. And then, you know, April, being the first human brought into the Turtles universe, is kind of the surrogate sister in a sense. So we sort of built this whole family around Casey, April, the four Turtles, and Splinter as the main heart and soul. And that seems to always be a constant in all the different things. And I think that's what binds it together for fans, even if you don't like the Michael Bay movies. There were some great things in the Michael Bay movies. We got to see Bebop and Rocksteady on the big screen for the first time and things like that.
But that's pretty awesome.
So, yeah, there's some stuff that, you know, I didn't particularly like them being 6 foot tall and bulletproof, but...
Hey, yeah. At least there weren't transforming robots.
Exactly. Yet. Yeah. No.
Yes, sir.
Speaking of Venus, do you think she would be received better nowadays?
That's a good question, and it's possible, because I do wonder that, because a lot of people go, you know, well, at least around then, they said, why the heck did you do that? And what's weird is the very short version of the story is we had actually explored the idea with New Line Cinema for a fourth Turtle movie that never got made, which was introducing a fifth Turtle named Kirby, a male Turtle. He was sort of washed a little bit further down. It was our tribute to Jack Kirby, and he was brought up differently, and there was, you know, we thought we came up with a good story that made that work. And then when that movie failed to go forward, and then Haim Saban, which is why there was the crossover with the Power Rangers, wanted to do it. So we had developed that TV series with a fifth Turtle from the beginning, but it was a male Turtle named Kirby. And then Margaret Lesh, who was head of Fox Kids at that time, wanted to do a girl Turtle. And we said, you know, we love strong female characters. We love our, you know, Ripley, Sigourney Weaver. We love, Tara Connor. You know, we love this. You know, this. There's always been a good female presence. So I thought this would be well received as a thing for the Turtles line, but there was a lot of pushback. So I think it probably would have been, it would be more well received. Yeah. We're all much smarter now.
More evolved,
yes.
Absolutely. In addition to Turtles, of course, that's not all you've done. Mm-hmm. Company that I respect a lot, Tundra.
Thank you.
Yep. Very much so. Talking about paying it forward to independent guys. Mm-hmm. I think that's where I discovered the Crow, James O'Barr's Crow, as well as Mike Allred with Madman. Madman. That stuff is incredible. Talk a little bit about the formation of Tundra.
Tundra was a wonderful experience for me, because I felt like Peter and I were, again, the industry is a comics industry is changing so much. During this time, the evolution of black and white comics and the boom and bust, they call it. There was a lot of once the Turtles succeeded, there was a lot of awareness in self-publishing. A lot more people were doing it and following the same footsteps that we were already following in. I always say that standing on the shoulders of giants, Peter and I were inspired by the Marvel, DC, and the other comics that we read and found our way into the business. And a lot of people wanted to pursue that as well, but just didn't have the opportunities. And what's even more interesting is, like, I'd go to comic conventions in the early days and be sitting with, I had a number of conversations with Todd McFarlane and Eric Larson and some of those guys who were doing some of the most popular comics at Marvel and DC, and they're like, oh, man, we should be doing our own stuff, and, you know, but we're stuck in this, stuck is not the most appropriate term, because they love doing Spider-Man, they love doing Hulk, and they love what they're doing, but they said, you know, we have a family, we have a mortgage, or we have rent, or we have this, and so it's hard for us to bust out from that monthly comic book schedule to, say, develop and do our own comics, our own thing. And this was consistent through, whether it's, you know, Alan Moore, who started self-publishing, there was Frank Miller, who moved to... There was a huge discussion in that, so I thought that with the formation of Tundra, it was to do something kind of similar to what the Beatles did way back in the day with Apple Records, which is to set up a way to fund properties, fund projects that wouldn't normally be funded or have the opportunities to be exposed in a larger way, and then allow the creators to keep their rights to those characters. So that was the foundation of Tundra. So, which was
a lot of great stuff came out of it.
Yeah, we did From Hell, and we did The Crow, said, and it was a lot of great stuff. I actually did the Words and Pictures Museum around this time, which is a real other dream come true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fantastic. Awesome. So, but,
I think we have a young man out there with a question.
Captain America, one of my favorites.
Excuse me, why did Donatello get a purple bandana?
That's a great question. we did, when we were choosing the colors for the headbands, we felt... Raphael would keep to the original red bandana because he's kind of our Wolverine character, so he's kind of angry all the time. So red seemed to be fitting for him. Orange for Michelangelo seemed perfect because it's kind of a sillier color, lighter, funner color. Michelangelo, we got a few Michelangelos.
Oh, yeah.
Leonardo with the blue, it was sort of a more regal royal color that akin to what the samurai might be, you know, the samurais were very loyal and well-trained and that kind of stuff. But Donatello was, his weapon was a bow staff, and that was a common weapon used by monks and often pacifists and people that, weren't even allowed to train with weapons in those days. But you could, someone well trained with a bow staff could disarm somebody with a sword in some cases. But we like the idea that it was more of a peaceful, pleasant color, and that seemed more in tune with technology and things that he would be interested in. So it was suiting for Donatello. Thanks for the question.
I have four sons, each with a starting initial.
No way.
Oh, that is
awesome. He doesn't like getting stuck with purple.
Donatello's a smart one. Everybody loves Donatello. I love him.
What's the question? Yell it, though, because people can't hear.
I got a question for Kevin Eastman. Do you have any advice for, someone who might want to break into comics and with their own self-published thing? Like, any advice at all?
Absolutely. Are you an artist, or are you an artist writer, or both?
Inspiring writer.
Aspiring writer, great. No, and what's so interesting about what you can do today, and as the world gets smaller, and I use that term because, with the internet and things like that, I used to spend a lot of time on a site called DeviantArt, and what was great about DeviantArt was they connected writers and artists from all over the world, not only people could join up with similar ideas and similar concepts, or if you're a writer looking for an artist, and I know there's a couple other sites, comicart.org, and there's a few other ones, but the internet has allowed to people to reach a wider audience quicker, easier, find people of like minds, like ideas and interests. If you like Doctor Who, you can go online and probably find a couple thousand Doctor Who related websites and people to hang out with that all talk about Doctor Who kind of things, or so on and so on. So I feel like there's an opportunity for you to reach a wider audience, to connect and to get your word for your ideas and your creations out there easier than word of mouth and what we did back in the day. That is a opportunity, and also there's a lot of competition out there. So you have to be diligent, much like, if you work at your craft, or if you are writing, you need to write every day. And I know that's not always easy. It's the same for your drawing, if you're interested in music or sports, or it applies to all those kinds of things. If you want to get better, you have to do it every day. And even if it's only for 20 minutes or 30 minutes, but work hard at it, because it'll make a difference. And, before you know it, if you're doing something every day to improve what you love and writing, that suddenly you spend 365 days working at it and you're getting better. And I say it's point specifically to in relation to the Turtles in proving is that when we did the first issue of the Turtles, which was 40 pages, the longest story I'd ever done was a 10-page story by myself, and Pete was about the same. So suddenly we were producing books like every 6 to 8 weeks, but they're 40-page books, and so we were literally drawing like 6 to 8 hours a week, and you could see how much we evolved as artists and writers, because we both wrote and drew them in that period of time. So don't give up the dream, work hard, and get the word out, and meet people with like minds and like ideas, and keep at it. Don't give up.
Okay. Go ahead.
Hey, so just my question is that, being somebody that grew up in 1993 and so then, so I kind of missed the old 90s Turtles, as I did not get into a done tell it show on Fox in 03, once the Fox rebranded Fox Kids to then Fox Box, and then I watched that whole cartoon storyline but until its very end. But then that's all I got into it. But if that the reason why I knew about the Ninja Turtles is because my older brothers were born in the 80s, then so we had so many Ninja Turtle toys.
Did you get them all?
Getting the mountains of Western Darkon, above that we even had these sleds.
Yeah.
That were the Ninja Turtles. Then so yes, I did get the toys for a bit, but we ended up giving them all to the Goodwill. I kind of wish.
Oh, that's nice.
But I kind of wish that we kept the sleds. But I don't think that bringing these toys were the brothers because they were well played with.
Well loved.
Gotcha. Yes.
They were well loved.
Yes, and how well aware. But about that, but my question is, looking back at seeing like all the toy craziness of the late 80s, did you ever get uncomfortable with just how much merchandise was being created, how much commercialized it was being with all the toys? Would you ever get uncomfortable with that at the time of just how much stuff was being made?
It was, you know, it's funny when we were, it's a really good question, by the way, and it's funny because it is, you know, I hear so many stories of, like, a couple things happen when we do these shows that I love, besides meeting you all, is, like, sometimes fans will bring up a book or a toy that, they'll bring up a toy that they've had since they were 4 or 5, and it's been chewed up, beat up, destroyed, and they would come up and end up. Practically apologize for, sorry, that's all I have for you to sign. I'm like, dude, you have, or, you know, ma'am, you don't know how incredibly cool this is that you not only loved this when you were that age, but you still kept this all this time, and your mom didn't throw it away. All that stuff. But that's a huge compliment to me, and I love that I get to experience and see some of those old comic books, because my comic book collection is beat to hell because I read them all the time and I loved them. And my mom didn't throw them away, thankfully, when I went to college. But there were, when we were going into licensing the Turtles, this was a new world to us in that, you know, we knew we had the toys, we had this, and then suddenly there was pajamas and they were, and like, okay, really? Okay, yeah, I could see that. I would wear, you know, Superman pajamas when I was a kid or Hot Wheels and stuff. And then, you know, each of these things kept adding on, and it was to the point that Peter and I would look at some of the Happy Meal things and some of the things and be like, what have we done? and the fact that they were selling, and then, you know, then it was, and it's funny, you know, reference the, how we do shows these days, is that back in those days when we do shows, say it was you, your brothers, and you might be about this tall, and your parents would be behind you, you might be excited to meet me, but your parents were really pissed off. And you could read their minds because they were thinking, like, do you know how much money I spent on Ninja Turtle underoos and Halloween costumes and how many, you know, Christmas Eves I stayed up putting together that stupid turtle sewer playset? Stepped on Leonardo's sword on the way to the restroom in the middle of the night. But it's it was. I mean, there was some stuff. We had some restraint. I know it probably doesn't seem like it, but there were some things that we, you know, that didn't happen, but it was pretty amazing to go through that and to see it work in the way that it did, because it was overwhelming. And, you know, a lot of times though, when you're going through it, you don't realize it till you stop. And I remember going, like, the first time I went to the movie premiere for the first movie in Paris, and I'd never been to Paris before. So I'm here in Paris for a movie premiere, so I'm standing looking at the Eiffel Tower, and there's this movie poster for the Turtles in French, and I'm like, what? This makes no sense to me, but it's amazing. So, yeah, it was pretty crazy. It was,
okay, it's good to know that there were things that you said no to on the merchandise.
Not many.
Okay, we got another question in the back.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering about the run that Image did back in the 90s. It's probably the most mature, most dark series that has ever been with the Ninja Turtles, you know, with Raphael losing an eye and Leo losing an arm. I was just wondering if you think you might do any more stories like that with IDW, especially since IDW is reprinting that run, and it only had like 24 issues, I think.
Yeah, I know, and I'm glad you brought it up, because we're literally right in the middle of that. I finished the cover for issue 13 before literally flying here. But this, what was neat about this series, it was at a time when there was little or no publishing going on with the Turtles on the Mirage side. We had licensed, Simon Bisley and I did a book called Body Count with Image, which was considered the most violent turtle story ever done. But it was still in the spirit of the original self-publishing, older, edgier Turtles that we were doing. But that Image run was supposed to go 26 issues, but it only lasted, it was finally canceled by issue 23. Just there were not enough sales to keep it going. So when after a long discussion with Nickelodeon and IDW, Nickelodeon owns the Turtles, that they agreed to publish it again. But I was adamant, and my advice to them was like, don't even bother going there if you're not going to commit to doing the whole thing and finishing those last three issues with the original art team of Gary Carlson and Frank Ford. Frank Bosco, sorry. And so that's what they're doing. So yeah, we're going to finish it in its entirety, but it is some there's some pretty crazy stuff in there. That's more like the original Underground Trouble. So
cool. That's cool. That's cool.
If you don't mind my backtracking back to the Venus thing.
Sure.
If Venus were to be reintroduced into
You get a little closer to the microphone? You can move it down. There you go.
If you don't mind my backtracking back to the Venus thing, if you think Venus were to be reintroduced into modern incarnations of the Turtles, would she still be limited as a love interest to the other Turtles, or would she be something completely independent?
No, I think it would be completely independent. In fact, I think that, you know, one of the, my favorite things about what Ciro Neely did with the 2012 Turtle series is I love that they took April's character and made her almost the same age as the Turtles. April's 16, the Turtles are technically 15 in the series. But she's got a, April has a number 5 on her shirt, and that's sort of our little symbol that she's the fifth turtle. And so she's in there, you know, giving the boys as good as it gets, you know, dishing it out, and she's right on the front lines of them, like I think, you know, most women are today. So I think that she'd be very much be in that same spirit. And that's what I love, many, many things I liked about the 2012 series, besides Ice Cream Kitty, which is the most awesome.
Great voice.
Yeah.
That,
what a voice. Who was that actor that was
incredible?
De Niro? Was it De Niro that did Ice Cream Kitty? But no, she would definitely be right in there with the boys. Yeah, I like that. That's important. I grew up with three sisters, so I was like, you know, I got beat up a lot by girls.
Okay, V, you got a question for us?
Yeah. You know, I have two questions, if that's okay with you all.
Sure.
You know, like, we're also talking about Turtles' great work, and like, what is your current project you're doing for now?
Say that again, please.
What are your current projects that you're working on?
Oh, the current projects I'm working on now? Thanks. We actually, it's funny and it's very interesting that I'm going back to self-publishing starting this May, and thanks to a lot of fans that supported, I did a Kickstarter last year with a co-creator, writer, Ben Avalone, and David Avalone and artist Ben Bishop. And Ben Bishop and I did the Turtles Target R series last year, which was fantastic. He's a fellow artist from Maine. And so we did a Kickstarter. We raised the funds to do 4 issues, which is the first part of 12 full story segments called Drawing Blood. And we're going back to self-publishing issue 1 starting in May, and we'll run through all 12 issues if the sales, if you guys support us. And it's based on a completely fictional true story. It's got some semi-autobiographical moments, but it's sort of a bit of Spinal Tap, a little Amadeus, a little Breaking Bad sort of isms about a fictional character named Shane Bookman. And his whole world is based in our world, the world of comic books. So it's sort of what he went through with early success, how he messed that up, and sort of him looking for his mojo, looking for his creativity again, while he's haunted and tortured by the characters he created, which are the radically rearranged Ronin Ragdolls, these three samurai cats named Miyazaki, Tezuka, and Otomo, named after our favorite Japanese animators. That's probably the main project I'm working on right now is Drawing Blood. I've got a few other things we're doing, but that's my first original. I've done lots of other projects, but this is I had to live through all of the other stuff to arrive at Drawing Blood, which I'm so excited about as a series. I think you guys get a big kick out of it. So.
All right, sounds really cool. Well, another question too, being a gamer, everything, like, what is your favorite Turtles video game of them all the time?
Oh yeah,
that's it. Because I'm terrible at them. I'm really terrible at them. I like the arcade game because I like you can play it with, like, you know, full on with, you know, back, you know, these days that our son is online with like 10 of his friends playing Fortnite or Rocket League or something, and then. But back then, that was the first game you could get, you know, 3 other friends and all play. So I like the Turtles Arcade, right? Stand up.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for your question. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Well, very cool. I don't think I want to leave here without asking you about heavy metal.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Absolutely.
That was my next question, actually.
So, yeah, tell us, because you mentioned earlier how heavy metal was an influence to you.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So what prompted you to get behind the publishing arm of that?
Well, what was amazing with heavy metal is that, I mentioned earlier, I discovered it. At a time, it was interesting. At a time when I was kind of growing out of comic books a little bit, only because I love the medium, but comic books during the 70s, especially the mid 70s, was sort of regulated by this authority called the Comics Code Authority, and it was this kind of silly system set up to regulate comics for kids only. So they were heavily regulated to you had to be for 12 and under or even younger. And about the time, I love them. I still love comic books, but I was starting to grow out of them. And then I discovered Heavy Metal Magazine, which not only published some of the underground comics artists that became a big influence, but a lot of European artists, which for a lot of these European artists like Mobius and Blyle and so many other fantastic talents, they evolved while American comics stayed sort of stagnant. And so the first time I went to a comic store in Paris, you saw business professionals, you saw women, you know, back which was very rare, see, you know, a female fan in a comic store back in the early 80s. So it was, and so that was really the eye-opening for me in that my commitment was reaffirmed and cemented, if you will, that comics are for all ages, and it's not like, you know, that thing that I, you know, when I would get made fun of in sixth grade, seventh grade, and eighth grade, you still read comic books? You know, I was a geek back when it was not a cool thing. But what was great about heavy metal is I discovered that it was this whole new world, and empowered me greatly, and a lot of other artists. So with the success of the Turtles, I found myself having a conversation with somebody who said in the late 80s that heavy metal was for sale. So I used some of my Turtle money, and I bought Heavy Metal Magazine in 1990 and published it. And still, I'm still publisher of the magazine. I don't own it fully like I used to, but I do. But it was one of those things that was a dream come true in that I still, for probably, this is probably 1990 to 2010, 2011, I pretty much picked every single story that went in the magazine, covers, everything. It was like, there was only a four-person company. But I ran and did everything with it, and it was one of those jobs that was definitely not a job because it was so much fun.
It's definitely nice to see it in the last few years get sort of another boost with Grant Morrison being involved. And
yep, that was true. I had a partner, Jeff Perlitz, came in, and he bought into the company, and he really had some great ideas to expand and grow the company because you know, newsstand distribution had changed so much, and there were so many things that we really had to refocus, many, many things, and that was Jeff's idea to bring in Grant Morrison, which I thought was absolutely brilliant, and it really changed the dynamic on a number of things. And it's more, you know, we're selling more copies of the magazine today on its, well, into its 40th year than we were 10 years ago.
So excellent. Has there been any talk about maybe another movie or more multimedia?
Yeah. No, I'm laughing because of yeah, there's a new series coming out on Netflix called Love, Death, and Robots, which originally was called Heavy Metal. A couple years ago, 2008, 2009, I worked with David Fincher and Tim Miller, who directed Deadpool, and we tried to raise money to do a Heavy Metal movie. We spent 4 years trying, and we couldn't. I spent a couple years with Robert Rodriguez also trying to raise money to do a Heavy Metal movie, and sort of as things have evolved, I think that, you know, heavy metal as a brand is sort of less important to the marketing people in Hollywood, and it's still a cool thing to the creative people. But I think I'd still love to see a heavy metal movie, and I haven't given up hope on doing a new one, fully branded heavy metal, something crazy fun. So,
yeah, first one's still one of my favorites.
Oh yeah,
I enjoy this one very, very much.
Oh yeah, when we reviewed it for our podcast, we were like, there's got to be more. There's got to be more. Your stuff is just ripe for it and everything.
Thank you. No, I'd love to. I would love to see another thing, especially what Ivan Reitman did in that original one was so awesome.
Exactly. Question.
You mentioned that Donnie being a pacifist, and I know that's always been a huge part of his character. In the 2012 iteration, what did you think of the addition of the blade on his staff?
It was funny. Yeah, it didn't really kill stuff.
Well, all right.
He started drinking. No, what was good? I liked, because that was what I loved. What Ciro nearly did with the series is that he did, he went back to actually kind of like what we did in the 90W series. We looked at a bunch of different Turtle universes to create a new universe to tell stories in. And I liked, Michelangelo, they made Mikey goofier, but he had a different kind of blade. He had part nunchuck and part something else. And with Donatello, was one of those things that so I think we evolved it into series. So I think we did the blade for a period of time, and then I think we all thought that was a little too un-Donatello, so then we made it into a steel, I think a solid Bosta. But yeah, there was a, it's funny, I was talking to another person today because, you know, you didn't get the joke, I do the voice of Ice Cream Kitty, or I did the voice of Ice Cream Kitty. And I just remember, like, when Cyril would do some of his ideas, and I'd read some of the, as I used to go up there all the time, and he saw that, wrote a couple episodes and stuff, but some of the stories are really messed up. Like, what? Yeah. You know, and he would bring in some, like, he did Robin England, he did Freddie, he got the voice of Freddie to do a voice, and James Hong from Big Trouble in Little China, and he would, like, even the episode of The Birth of Ice Cream Kitty, which was this reintroduction, or the introduction of Rat King as a character into the storyline, and it was just a, you know, just the death of Ice Cream Kitty to be reborn into this cat made of ice cream was like, that's scary as hell. I'm like, Shiro, dude, he can, like, you know, do it off camera, but he's got the cat going. and then Rat King as a character was really scary. And then they did this one episode of, like, the pizza zombies was this guy throwing pizzas on these people's head, and they turn into these zombies. So yeah, we tried a bunch of different things, but it's still one of my favorite all-time Turtle series. The exploration was really neat, and I'm glad we got to finally bring in Usagi Yojimbo fully back into the Turtle series.
Yes.
Pretty awesome. Well, that is going to wrap up our time with
you. Yes, I think
it just flew by.
You're still going to be on the floor?
No.
Actually, they're leaving.
We have to be on a plane in an hour and a half.
Yeah, so we're literally
I was waiting.
No, it's right. We came in Friday. We had a pizza party with a whole bunch of y'all. It was really super fun. And we had an incredibly wonderful and exceptionally fun filled day yesterday. Thanks for standing in those lines. You guys are crazy. I love you. I always joke I wouldn't stand in line to see me. I'm really glad you guys do. And I always like to say that I get to sit up here and I get to sit behind the table because I have the best. I have the best job in the world because I have the best fans in the world. So I really appreciate you coming and hanging out.
From all of us here at South Carolina Comic Con, thank you for everything.
Thank you. We've had a blast with you guys. Thank you very much.
Welcome to A Geek Girl's Take. I'm your host, Angela, and this week, this Geek Girl is talking about some upcoming television and movies I'm excited for. So first, I'm going to start with TV. We have a lot of great new stuff starting, and a few that I'm really excited for are the new Sabrina the Teenage Witch Season 2 on Netflix. It starts on April 4th, and I'm super, super excited to see what happens to Sabrina and the other characters in the show, especially after how Season 1 and the Christmas special ended. So it's just going to be really interesting to see how the show progresses with its second season, and if it will do well enough to survive for a third season. I really hope so, because I really adored the first season of it. The next one I'm really excited for is a cartoon done on Disney XD called Star vs. the Forces of Evil. This is the last season of this fantastic show that, if you have not seen it, you should go back and watch all of it to prepare yourself for the final season. I am super pumped to see what happens in it, because last season was such a nail-biter, and I'm just really, really hoping they go out really, really strong and just as amazing as the last season was. So movies that I'm super excited about that you should check out if you haven't heard of are Us, the new horror movie from Jordan Peele. This is his second horror movie since his debut for Get Out, which was fantastic, and I'm really, really excited for it. The previews are making it seem like it's so unique, and that's something we don't see a lot in horror movies recently. So I'm really, really excited for this because the acting looks like it's going to be amazing. The storyline looks like it's going to be different. So it seems like it's going to be a really great film. Another movie I'm really excited for that most people have been groaning about are Shazam. So I'm really excited for this film just because it looks funny and like it's going to be a good time. And when I go to see a movie, sometimes that's all I want. I don't need it to be a cinematic masterpiece. I want to laugh and I want to have fun with the film. And that's exactly what this movie seems like it's going to be. So I'm really excited for this one. And then my last film that I'm really excited for is the new Pet Sematary remake.
the previews for this Stephen King classic make it look really promising. Like, it looks like it's going to be creepy and that it's going to, you know, have a great story to it. It's going to be adapted well. So I'm really excited for this one. Like, I know a lot of people groaned when they heard they were making a Pet Sematary remake. I don't really know how you would put that. But the previews for this look really great, so I'm really excited for it. And there are so many great movies coming out and great television right now. I'm just pumped to get to, like, see it all. Well, thanks for listening to A Geek Girl's Take. What will I talk about next week? Well, you're going to have to listen to find out.
For the week of March 20th, 2019, it's the ESO Network Con Report.
Well, there's one show that's coming up at the end of March. Actually, it's this weekend, the 22nd through the 25th, and that is MetrothamCon. That is in East Ridge, Tennessee. We had a couple of the organizers on with us a few weeks ago talking all about this inaugural event. It's the first time ever for this convention. East Ridge, Tennessee is near Chattanooga, which is a great location. Should be a great show. They've got a lot of great guests, including... pat myself on the back here. Myself and Peter Cutler will be up there representing, of course, Earth Station One, the ESO Network, as well as Tiki Zombie. It's going to be a blast. Our good friends, Ricky and Bambi, who perform with Radio Cull. They perform just by themselves acoustically. They perform with Possum King Ramblers. They perform with Learning to Count, which is a Ramones cover band. They will be doing some of that. I know that they're definitely performing as Radio Cult on Friday night, and I think they're going to have some other performances throughout the weekend, some of the other projects as well. So expect some good music to be played at MetrothamCon. And, of course, we know them from doing the music spotlights here on the Earth Station One podcast. So they're great friends and they're great musicians. So that's reason enough alone to go to MetrothamCon, but lots of other reasons as well. Check out the website, MetrothamCon.com, for the latest information as far as how you can reserve your tickets for this weekend. And we hope to see you there. And for shows that are coming up in April, right now, don't have anything on the agenda yet, except I do know that Richard from the PWR Spot Show, he's going to be attending his first ever WrestleMania, which is taking place in Jersey, I believe. If you're going to be at WrestleMania, you can try to find Richard in that mass of people. And then we're still getting some dates in for May. So watch this space. And meanwhile, if you have a convention that's coming up that you want to still promote or participate in or just want to rant and rave about, please reach out to us because we love talking about conventions.
So that's going to wrap up another episode of the Earth Station One podcast. Whew, we feel like we've really worked, you know, going between here and South Carolina. It's just like crazy. Thank God we have teleporters here on the station. Mike, we made it through another one, my friend.
We did. And as always, it's my pleasure.
Anything you want to shout out about, sir?
Well, I'm still really coming down from a great South Carolina Comic-Con, SC Comic-Con experience. I mean, I'm glad that we were able to air the Kevin Eastman, and big thanks to Kevin Eastman for allowing us to share the stage with him. Big thanks to Mick Foley, even though we weren't able to air that segment, to hang out with him as well. So that was a great, I'm glad we were able to share the Kevin Eastman one. So I'm hoping that people who are listening, enjoyed that.
Podcast panel that we did in South Carolina.
Yeah, don't want to forget that. That was a fun panel as well, hanging out with our fellow podcasters and talking to some people who are up-and-coming podcasters.
Exactly.
That was a really great time. We always love doing those and talking about
how it's so important to get your voice out there. And kind of speaking of which, I'm going to talk about another podcast. I'm going to give a shout out to our friends over at the Story Geeks. I know, they're not officially on the network, but they're such good friends of the station.
Those guys again.
I have to give them a shout out because, yes, I was on a podcast recently where I moderated one of their nerd fights to determine who the best live-action Batman is, and that's already available. And then in a couple weeks, they will be releasing the second nerd fight that I moderated, that I judged in, where we determine who the best live-action or best interpretation of Spider-Man is. And so I am the moderator, the judge, if you will, and our good friend Jay, Sandra Demas, and Justin Weaver, they are giving arguments. And it's a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun. And it's kind of stressful because it's not easy to be the guy who has to make the ultimate decisions. But they do a really good job at defending their picks. So I know that we've had Jay on before in the Geek Seat. We've had Daryl on the show, but the two new co-hosts over there, Sandra and Justin, I think the Geek Seat awaits them, man. So tune in to all goodness at the Story Geeks, and we give them a big shout out.
Fantastic. And yeah, you are such a level-headed individual. But, you know, I assure you were completely impartial, of course.
Oh, yes, of course. Of course. Yes.
Yes, of course. Harumph, harumph. Of course you were. Yeah. Could see that happening. Well, that's awesome. And my shout out real quick goes out to our own Nerd Bliss podcast. That's right. They just celebrated their 100th episode. And they had me on it to help celebrate. Isn't that awesome?
Hey, and you're also on 99, right?
I am on 99 and 100. This is
I actually appear on 99 myself because they talked to us all at South Carolina Comic Con. So
exactly, and they even talked to Judy. Can you believe that?
So definitely check out episode 99 of Nerd Bliss, and yeah, I guess 100 too.
Yeah, no, it's a momentous event when a podcast hits 100.
It's a momentous event when a podcast hits 10. So yeah,
good point.
So as we talked about on our panels, when we do podcasting panels, it's an amazing ride. And to get to 100, I remember when we got to 100 and it feels like
it was surreal.
Yeah. It's just like you're in a groove. So.
No, exactly. And that's where it gets really crazy. And so I'm really, you know, very proud of the podcast there, and I'm very happy for them and Chris and, of course, Tina and Dan and the rest of the crew. They have done a great product, and it's great to see them, you know, continually evolve. And here's to the next 100 for them. So bravo, my friends. Bravo.
Absolutely. Very consistent. And congratulations, guys. And we'll since we've made appearances on the shows, I'm expecting a check in the mail. So
of course, royalties are accepted anytime. Yep,
absolutely.
You know, we sign those agreements, you know, to appear on the shows. But we could be on your show, too. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Mike and I are available. Mike records almost every night on other podcasts already. So
we're not proud.
No, we are not. So Mike and Mike are available. So if you're a podcaster and want our dulcet tones on your podcast, please write us at feedback@esonetwork.com. And we'd be glad to join you on any show, no matter what the topic is.
I've got two more to record this week.
See, there you go. So with that being said, thank you guys for joining us this week. We will be back again next week when we are going to be talking all about the art of John Byrne. So that should be interesting to talk about, you know, all the way from when he first started with Marvel through his DC time, through his Next Men era. It's going to be interesting to see, you know, what goes on in the world of John Byrne and such. So with that, we will see you then. My name is Mike Faber. Peace. And we're done.
Boom. Boom. Boom, he says.
Uh-huh.
Boom.
You've been listening to the Air Station One podcast, a show by fans for fans. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe to our show up on iTunes or wherever fine podcasts are found. While you're up there, please rate us and remember to leave feedback. It would greatly be appreciated. And remember to tell your friends all about us while you're at it. Air Station One is available on most social media sites where you can join some really great topics or chats. Help support our show by shopping through our Amazon.com link or purchasing very cool ESO Network clothing and merchandise at our TeePublic store. Links to both are found on the top of our ESO Network webpage. Become a patron of the ESO Network by backing us up on Patreon for as little as 25 cents a week. Go to patreon.com/ESO Network to sign up. We want to hear from you. Please write us at earthstation1@esonetwork.com or call us at 404-963-9057. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time here on the Earth Station 1 podcast. Peace, and we're done.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.